The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org. Yes.
And I just want to clarify, I am in no way a neuroscientist any more than there's probably neuroscientists here, but I am not a professional neuroscientist, but I do love the brain and neurons, and I'm just really fascinated by it. Also, just another disclaimer, the idea that I couldn't have like audio visuals terrified me, so I had to have Ori draw pictures and get Play-Doh and models of the brain and all other kinds of stuff and handouts, so just to make sure that you would know what I'm talking about while I'm talking. So the short version of this talk is that neuro is related to the nervous system. In this particular talk, I'll talk mainly about the brain. And plasticity, meaning not the hard outside part of the Play-Doh container, but the actual soft, gushy insides that can be, if I can get this off, that can be molded or malleable. That's what we mean by plasticity. And I like to squeeze Play-Doh while I talk, so forgive me, but I have Play-Doh for you too if you need to squeeze it while I'm talking. So why should socialists care about the brain? Of course we all have one and we want to take care of our brains and the brains of other people, but the very concept of neuroplasticity shows us that throughout our lifetimes we're capable of change in thought, in individual behavior, and in group behavior. And our brain, as Moeb Castandi, this book is an excellent primer on neuroplasticity. It's at Haymarket, you should check it out. Moeb Castandi writes, it's not only capable of changing, but it does so continuously throughout life in response to everything we do and every experience that we have. And socialists have for centuries now been arguing that humans are not only capable of individual change, but often based on the experiences in our world, but that we are capable of changing history and the very society that we live in, as well as the technology that we use to modify our environment. So unlike theories of being hardwired and are we having primordial violent tendencies espoused in fields such as evolutionary psychology, the theory of neuroplasticity takes an extremely dialectical approach to understanding the human nervous system and its evolution that enables us to adapt to a variety of environments and determine the best course of action, or sometimes the worst course of action, in any given situation based on what we've learned from past experiences. In other words, our brains learn from their history, they formulate a response to the present, and allow us to act on the future and for the future. So I think that the question of neuroplasticity changes the question of nature versus nurture to one of being our nature, our brains. Role is to nurture, change, and mold our world as our world molds our brains. In short, our brains are dialectical. Actually, we have a dialectical understanding of our brains. So what is neuroplasticity? It's basically the brain's ability to reorganize itself by forming new neural connections throughout the lifetime in response to the environment and experiences that we have, in response to external forces. Now, it's not just a free-for-all. That process of building neural pathways is mediated by internal forces in our bodies, such as genetic expression, the brain structure, injury, neurochemical transmission, metabolic changes, hormones, and neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells. But the idea that the brain is plastic is not a new one. But like most science under capitalism, it developed alongside technology to analyze cells in the brain and the spinal cord, and it was fraught with disagreement from the start. In the 1700s, some natural scientists said, yes, the brain can can grow from mental exercises. But in opposition, phrenologists, the people that posited that all human characteristics are determined by skull size, which led to very racist conclusions, had other ideas and were somewhat dominant. It's with the advent of cell theory in the 1830s, with the help of microscopes, of course, that scientists believe that all living things are composed of cells, and that that we can somehow change. But the microscopes at that point aren't powerful enough to view the nervous system. But it's interesting that William James in 1890 defined plasticity as the possession of a structure weak enough to yield to an influence, but not yield all at once. So I think it's a lot like Plato. He expanded on that idea by saying habit formation, whether good or bad habit formation, was about strengthening synapses and forming new connections. He says, if habits are due to the plasticity of materials to outside agents, we can immediately see what outward influences, if any, the brain matter is plastic. And it is to the infinitely attenuated currents that pour in through the sensory nerves that the hemispherical cortex, or the brain, shows itself to be peculiarly susceptible. The currents, once in, must find a way out. And in getting out, they leave their traces in the paths which they take. The only thing they can do, in short, is to deepen old paths or make new ones. And I think it's a beautiful naturalistic description of what actually happens with brain cells and synapses in our brain. Spanish neuroanatomist Santiago Ramón y Cajal used new staining methods and microscopes in the 1890s to examine nerve tissue, and based on discoveries, produced beautiful drawings of neurons, the cells of the neural systems. If you can ever look at them on the internet, they're really fascinating. And he became kind of the founding father of neuroscience. He argued that the dendritic spines, which are these, were actually really important, while other scientists were kind of ignoring them. And as it turns out, he was so very right. Dendritic spines offer multiple sites for our brains to connect, and I'll discuss that a little bit later on. The other thing that he suggested is that the plasticity doesn't happen within the nerve cells themselves, but in the junction between the nerve cells. And so, sorry. That's the junction. That's later became called a synapse. British neuroscientists developed on that idea and called them synapses, and postulated that learning took place in that site where the nerve cells direct their energy and begin to amplify their connections. So some scientists said, well, if your brain just keeps growing and generating new nerve fibers, wouldn't your brain just continue to grow and grow and grow, and we'd all look like bobbleheads? But no. Ramón y Cajal later suggested that nerve cells, some cell bodies shrink as others grow, and that's actually, in effect, to a certain extent, what happens is those two theories, the strengthening of synapses and neuropruning, that are central to today's theory of neuroplasticity. Unfortunately, Ramón y Cajal then said later in 1913 that all those changes ended at adulthood and we were hardwired since then, and that then becomes the dogma of neuroscience for quite some time, because it's what the founding father has said, right? It's not till the 1960s that the hardwired, unchanging brain theory became challenged with new experiments with really pretty amazing results. Paul Bacchi-Rita produced evidence of sensory substitution in individuals with congenital blindness, which showed that the adult brain can produce new cells to novel stimulation. In the 70s, Bliss and Lomo discovered long-term potentiation, or LTP, the mechanism by which synapses can be strengthened for prolonged periods of time. I'll discuss that a little bit as well. And then neurophysiologists William Jenkins and Mike Messernich presented research of neuroplasticity in the adulthood that was presented in the 1980s. So now by the 1990s, this discovery has been replicated and the evidence is replicated. It shows without a doubt that the adult brain can actually produce new brain cells and actually change and learn. So I now need to go through a short neuroanatomy course that's a I'll try to make it brief and be as clear as possible, but please bring up questions. I have brains up here. I have Play-Doh. People can squeeze while they're trying to figure it out. Some people should have an outline that I handed out that shows the nervous system, which is typically divided in anatomy into the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. The central being the brain and the spinal cord. Peripheral is pretty much all of the nerves that are outside of the spinal cord that are throughout our body. And then the brain has some basic structures. You have the brain stem. Oops. There's the brain stem. It rests on the spinal cord, the cerebellum, which is at the base of the brain, the limbic system, which is the central portion of the brain, and then the cerebral cortex, or the cerebrum, which covers the brain. And they don't usually fall apart like that. So this top portion, the cerebral cortex, was then divided by neuroanatomists in discrete anatomical parts in the late 19th and up to the mid-20th century, breaking up the brain into the four lobes with specialized functions and was pretty well-established science. And that was, at least that was based on scientific experiments of patients with stroke and autopsy on their brain. It wasn't phrenology. There was a reason, and there's some structural validity to that. But still today, we talk about the lobes of the brain, which are basically the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe, the occipital lobe, and the temporal lobes. Those are the four main areas of lobes of the brain. But it's also been discovered that the brain is very plastic and subject to change, so that organization of brain regions and specific functions might not be as localized or limited as was once thought. So for example, the occipital lobe, this lobe, normally houses the visual cortex, but it's also thought to process information from other senses and also possibly aid in the formation of language. So there are other functions that these parts of the brain are figuring out. But then how did neuroscientists begin to determine that the nervous system, particularly the brain, is so plastic and responsive to environment and experience? It's with the advent of more elaborate technology, from the electron microscope in the mid-20th century to today's functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRIs, where you can actually see the brain in action, that neuroscientists can look far beneath the organ structures of the and look at the basic brain cells, the neurons and glial cells, and discover how they work and what they're doing. So bear with me, I'm going to go through the cells and what they do, and then we're going to talk about how capitalism messes us up. So nerve tissue is very busy tissue, and it's not just in the brain, but I'm mainly going to focus on the brain. It's very densely packed with two types of cells, neurons and glial cells, and neurons are the stars of the nerve tissue. They get all the attention because they're highly specialized, and they're also very hungry. They take up about 25% of your daily calories are taken up by the neurons. They're very highly competitive for space in the brain as well. And the glial cells, which don't get nearly enough credit, but it also turns out that they're also highly specialized. And they're important for structural support, for cleaning, for immunity, and for efficient transfer of impulses. But they don't need as much energy. They also outnumber neurons 10 to 1. But like I said, they don't get the credit that they need for work. So next year, we'll have a talk on glial cells. But I will talk mainly about the neurons. They're electrically excitable nerve cells that receive, process, and transmit information via chemical and electrical signals. So there's three classes, or main classes, of neurons. One are sensory neurons, the ones we're probably most familiar with, because they bring information signals to the central nervous system and then try to bring in, get it to integrate and form a response. And then motor neurons, which hopefully take a hopefully integrated response through signals from the central nervous system and take them out so that we respond. The other neurons are interneurons. They're only in the central nervous system, and they connect neurons to each other. They receive information from some neurons and then transfer information to other neurons. And they're by far the most numerous of the neurons and involved in what we call information processing. Okay, from simple reflexes to more complex circuits of judgment, reasoning, and remembering from our previous experience. Okay, so nerve cells do three things. They receive information, they integrate information, decide whether it's important or not, and then communicate to other cells, whether it's other neurons, whether it's to muscles, or to glands. Okay. All right, we'll see. So now I want to talk just really quickly about what a nerve cell looks like, which was beautifully drawn by Ori. Basically, they're made up of dendrites, a cell body, and an axon, okay? The dendrites are long or short, but they have little bumps or spines, and they look like bushes and trees. They receive a processing, electrical signals from a stimulus. Along with the cell body and nucleus, they process a signal that says either fire, which is to generate an action, okay, that's known as excitatory, or a signal that says don't fire, that's inhibitory. Most neurons have many, 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 many dendrite spines and dendrite trees with multiple spines, so they're receiving thousands and thousands of impulses. If there's enough to fire a nerve impulse, that's called an action potential, and it goes through to the axon. The axon can be long, it can be very short, but it's generally smooth. Some are covered with a sheath of myelin. This is the myelin. And that acts as an insulator or an electric conductor for electrical impulses to move quickly. If people know people with multiple sclerosis, it affects the myelin sheath and interrupts that process. The action potential, or that nerve impulse, starts near the cell body, runs through the axon, and ends up at the axon terminal. And that's where the nerve impulse has to jump across the synapse to continue carrying the information. So that's where this happens. This is one cell, the presynapse. This is the other cell, the postsynapse. That's where learning takes place. The action potential, or that nerve impulse, goes from one neuron that's sufficiently excited, and it's transmitted across the synapse via chemical messengers called neurotransmitters. People might be familiar with neurotransmitters. They cross the synapse, bind to membranes, receptors in the receiver of the message, and then convey an excitatory or inhibitory signal. And then dendrites from the next neuron receive this message, and either in the spines or the shaft of the dendrite, and just keep on going. So in 1897, one of the neurophysiologists, Charles Sherrington, described the movement this way. Shut off from all opportunities of reproducing itself, the nerve cell directs its pent-up energy towards amplifying its connections with its fellows in response to the events which stir it up. And that makes an important point, because it's not one single neuron that alone creates much action. It has to amplify connections with other neurons in response to events that stir it up to make things happen. So neurons work together in groups that form networks to receive, process, and respond to external and internal stimuli, and that's how cells can become specialized. And it's that processing and response that creates a simple reflex or a very complex thought. The more neurons that fire together eventually will wire together and create more smooth automatic responses in neuropathways. So you might see this with a child who learns to walk. One day they take one step, next day they're taking more and more. and their brains are acquiring all of that information and setting down new pathways. So let's translate this into a real life scenario. And I did think of you, Orit, when I talked about this. Let's imagine that you have a spider on your leg. And I know how much you love spiders. So you see and you feel and you hear that spider. It's a stimulus. Your sensory neurons bring that information into the central nervous system. The dendrites pick up that stimuli and along with the cell nucleus decide on an excitatory or inhibitory response, depending on whether you love and hate or hate spiders. And that sets off a nerve impulse through the axon of the neuron that either blasts excitatory information through or inhibitory impulses to other neurons into the neuromuscular junction. And based on your past experience of spiders, your neurons work together to enact a response. Either you move your leg, or you might run away, or you might smash the spider with your hand. So that's one response you can have. Or you remember reading Charlotte's Web and how great spiders are, and you watch the spider keep moving, and you fall into a lull of contemplative thought, which would be my response, but not everyone's. Every person's reaction is somewhat different because your brain neurons have created synapses that wire together and form pathways that that produce a response in a unique way. It's based on a number of external factors. How big is the spider? How hairy is it? Is it daytime, nighttime? Is it poisonous? Are you inside, outside? Who have you interacted with that day? But it's also based on a number of internal factors, some of which is your previous experience with spiders, your knowledge of arachnoids, your vision, your sense of touch, your neurochemical balance, your gene expression. You might come from a family of spider haters, and your metabolism. But would it be expressed? That's the question. All right, so neuroplasticity is the theory that our brains can change in response to the environment based on understanding that a single neuron communicates across the synapse with other neurons, and that's multiplied by thousands of neurons reacting similarly. An understanding of how synapses can be strengthened over prolonged periods of time. That physiological mechanism, as I said before, was long-term potentiation. And that discovery helps us understand how we learn and remember in terms of either stronger or weaker transmissions across synapses, how brains build and create strong neuropathways. So long-term potentiation was one of the most studied mechanisms in the brain, but still neuroscience is very, very early in understanding how memory works, to be honest, and how it can be enhanced. And the opposite of that is long-term depression that makes neurotransmission weaker and less efficient. Forgetting Spanish 101 if you haven't used it for 15 years. So how much time do I have? So there's a variety of levels in which synapse can be modified, a variety of time periods. Some happen at the cell level, some happen, and I went to a webinar and they described it as like the cell level is almost like the dendrites that change, and thinking of them as the gates on a terminal of an airport. So you have different gates and they can all change at times. That's kind of the micro level or functional plasticity, and that can happen in milliseconds. There's 86 to 100 billion neurons in our brain alone. Every neuron has as many dendrites that each have dendritic spines. So as you can guess, that's a lot of gates in a lot of terminals. And our brains are constantly adapting to our environment. It's also true that at the macro level, or if you look at the airport, the map of airports, if you have ever flown and you look at like those maps of where the flights go and the airports, that's kind of what can happen with the brain. You can have structural changes where there's new neural pathways of synapses and dendritic branches, which happen in a matter of hours. And that can also happen, of course, over time. I won't go into one of, there's some examples, and I think that they're pretty fascinating, where you can see where one part of the brain is actually being used to serve another function based on injury, but I could go on about that forever. I don't have, but and I'm not going to, I don't have the knowledge or time to elaborate on internal factors that affect neuroplasticity, but I wanted to mention several principles of understanding how conscious experience can change plasticity of the nervous system. There is a list on that handout I gave you. They're the general principles of experience-dependent neuroplasticity. People have probably heard the first one the most, use it or lose it. Basically, if you stimulate a certain brain function, it will get stronger or it will degrade. The other is use it and improve it. If you train to do something in particular, that will enhance that function. So if you think of that as language learning, for example, I think all of that comes into play. Either you learn a language and keep using it, in which way you're going to strengthen those neural pathways, or you learn the language and don't use it, in which case those are going to be weaker neural pathways. Specificity is important. These are a lot of principles that hold up in rehab. Repetition, doing something over and over again, certainly creates new neural pathways and automaticity. Intensity matters, time matters. If salience matters, if it's important to a person, then they're going to learn it more quickly and more thoughtfully. Age matters, and unfortunately, it is true that younger brains learn more readily than others, and generalization or transference and interference also matter. So all of those are important factors that matter with conscious training, but there are many other environmental factors that act on these experiences and training that are carried out. So I want to discuss, finally, how the concept of neuroplasticity can both create enormous potential for us as humans and as individuals and as a society, but how those constraints under capitalism play out. Okay. I think, one, all the neuroscientific research indicates humans have tremendous potential for learning and change throughout the lifespan. And the technology that's being used is really developing as well. I think that's tremendously exciting. We no longer have to base things on an autopsy or injury to see what the brain is actually doing. fMRIs and transcranial magnetic stimulation allow us to actually see what the brain is doing while somebody is completing an action, even though that's still pretty limited. If you've ever had an MRI, you know how limiting it can be to be in that little chamber. But it's also true, there's all kinds of studies now that are showing how neurochemicals and gene expression can have a negative or positive impact, especially glucocorticoids that are released when our body is stressed, in good ways, but also in most often in this society in negative ways, and studying how stress impacts how our brains function. But neuroplasticity to me means our brain power, although it's not infinite and it's not without constraints, it's not hardwired or genetically determined either. So think of what potential that has for undermining the notion of some kind of predetermined sexual, national, or racial, ethnic traits that are biologically based. Think of the potential for our ability to learn, both positive and negative, that can be unlearned. So I went to the talk last night on addictions and the opioid crisis, and thinking through, like, what does this mean for people? There's a tremendous potential for learning new ways and for creating new neural pathways for those with harmful addictions, for those who have suffered trauma, or for those who might be harming themselves. There's potential for what our brains and bodies can learn in a world in which negative stress is reduced, even by half. Imagine what our brains could take in and process and contemplate if we weren't stressed about time and money and healthcare and war and all the myriad forms of oppression that compound our stress in this society and really damage our bodies every day. and also the potential for how we can recover from injury and change the course of some degenerative diseases like Parkinson's and MS by non-drug-related interventions and simply by human activity. So for decades, the dogma of neuroscience was that our brains were simply deteriorate after 18 or maybe 25 years of age, that minimal learning could take place, that we lose brain cells with every sip of alcohol or gram of drugs that we take, and brains that couldn't adapt or heal from injury after 6 months. But, and that the only intervention was really drugs and more drugs and just deal with it. So no matter what, I think that neuroplasticity promises tremendous, exciting potential to learn and change ourselves and change the world we live in. In fact, change is an intrinsic part of our nervous system, for better or worse, because what makes us capable of doing good things, whatever good things are, like good stress, analyzing the world, socialism conferences, are also the neural basis for what leads us to do bad things like rage and anger and addiction and ever expanding and modes of violence. I think it's an exciting theoretically because it posits that our brains develop and act on our material world as we are developed and acted on by our material world. And so I think it's a beautiful example of how dialectics help us understand the brain. As socialists, I think we have a dialectic understanding of this interplay between internal processes and external processes. I think we can encourage study and change of both internal biological factors as well as change in external experience and environmental factors that can better our life on the planet. But it should come as no surprise that socialists generally think that capitalism constrains those possibilities for a better life on this planet. How has capitalism managed to limit, constrain, and reduce the possibilities of what neuroplasticity represents? I mean, everybody in this room could think of a million ways, that's true. But for one, I think that the way that capitalism has harnessed the possibilities of neuroplasticity, especially in the United States, focuses pretty exclusively on the individual, with minimal mention of how the brain changes to external forces, the environment and experience. And nowhere do we see in this in two areas of society that hold the most promise for what we're capable of creating with our neuroplastic brains, education and healthcare. So, if you look at education, developmental specialists have long known that the brain has a critical period of brain growth and synaptic pruning during the first 3 years of life. That's absolutely true. But we now know that those critical periods are not the only time that we can change our brain, and that's tremendously important. That should translate into a society flourishing with multiple creative, lifelong opportunities to develop and train all kinds of skills, from preschools to retirement centers. And neuroscientists have confirmed that there are known skills that we can learn as children, and to a lesser extent as adults, that are neuroprotective, that give us a cognitive reserve against damage. One is learning a language, learning how to play music or sing music. One is meditation, really hardcore Tibetan monk meditation for like 16 hours a day, but still meditation. Yet, that hasn't translated into an explosion of music programs and language programs and meditation programs being developed in preschools, universities, and workplaces. Instead, in the world of austerity and 25-year-old textbooks, what does emerge are self-help books, computer programs, and brain games. A quick internet search of neuroplasticity training brings up, first thing, online video training program, Positive Neuroplasticity Training, with Rick Hansen, a PhD. So for $200 to $400, you can get a video that shows you how to grow specific inner strengths to heal old pain and turn these experiences into resilient happiness, love, and peace, hardwired into your nervous system in a topsy-turvy world. So, of course, I'm not saying that that hurts your brain, but it does kind of look at the individual activation of neural pathways in isolation while acknowledging that we live in a pretty messed up world and somebody makes a buck off it. So while research shows that one-on-one cognitive behavioral therapy and group therapy can help individuals address their PTSD and all kinds of mental impairments. The capitalist market produces video and brain games. Even Mike Mesernich, the neuroscientist who produced research on how the brain can rewire given new inputs, is known for inventing Fast Forward, an expensive computer program that claims to improve children's language skills, but the results are very equivocal at best. It helps some kids, it doesn't help others. Well, yeah, you could say that about any program, really. So where is the demand out of neuroplasticity to hire classroom teachers and reading specialists to develop individual approaches instead of using some kind of one-size-fits-all computer program? So instead of focusing our energies on the education system that can create learning experiences, environments conducive to learning, we get classrooms that are filthy or toxic, especially in Chicago, fewer human resources to stimulate young minds and old minds, and standardized tests. And not to mention a physical environment outside of school that's stressful, high-tech, and low-touch. Contributions to understanding how our brains work. Lori DeSantos has a program where it teaches children and adolescents how their brains work, what they can do to calm their brains and help change their own behaviors, and sets up classrooms with amygdala reset stations and breathing exercises. Those kind of ideas can help foster spaces for self-awareness and priming for learning. But they're too far and few. They're far from the norm in most school districts and workplaces. What I think the theory of neuroplasticity posits about our nervous system and our brain can take in so much from the environment and make sense of it and change because of it, and in turn act on it, and indicates that we're capable of addressing these larger structural questions of how we can create beneficial environments for learning that are much more expansive than a computer program. So as we know, the system of profit for which all production takes place under capitalism has little benefit from placing its resources into social structures and stimulate and nurture the hearts and minds of the majority. In some ways, that limitation, I think, begins with the way that neuroscience is funded in universities and towards what goals, usually for changes on a pretty small scale for individuals and far too often for pharmaceutical companies. I work in healthcare, it's a similar scenario in healthcare. Medical care, especially health insurance plans, focus on the individual taking control of your health, but not really in addressing the environmental factors that negatively impact how we deal with the stresses of work, of racism, of sexism, of environmental degradation. How many workplaces have plans that punish somebody for smoking, being overweight, having high blood pressure, but have no sick days, no daycare, no lunch breaks, or cafeterias with healthy food? Those would be neuroplastic changes that would actually benefit the vast majority. And walking 10,000 steps each day to improve cardiovascular health is fine. I put it sometimes on my phone, but it depends on where you're walking. And then you could be exposed to environmental toxins, gunfire, racist police, sexual harassment. Again, it's not to knock exercise at all or eating a proper healthy diet. Eat all the acai berries you want and drink plenty of water. We just need to get the lead out of the water because that's a neurotoxin. And we need to have grocery stores and food deserts that serve fresh fruit. So it's not really addressing the structural things that we know that we actually can change. I just want to give one example of where I work in inpatient rehab, because I work with people who have had stroke, traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, and some neurodegenerative diseases. And research shows explicit evidence that people can make continued gains in acute and chronic stages of the recovery in a variety of settings, but insurance, and I see mainly Medicaid, Medicare, and no insurance patients, covers comprehensive inpatient rehab for 2 to 3 weeks. Maybe a patient with a spinal cord injury might get 4 to 6 weeks if they have quadriplegia, and then they're kicked out. And who is it that's responsible for their continuing rehab? The patient and their family. So in Chicago, where you have 3 flats that are walk-ups, you're told, go home, find a way to go up two or three flights of stairs, make sure someone can help you use the toilet and dress and cook for you and make sure your medications are taken correctly. And on the off chance, if you can get down those stairs, find a way to get to outpatient rehab, wait for 2 or 3 hours and take you, so somebody can take you home, get you back up the stairs, you can continue rehab for 6 weeks. Everything we know about the brain and experience and training tells us that's wrong. But that's the trend, and that's been the trend in rehab for years. And no advance in telehealth or talking over the computer via Skype can take the place of hands-on, face-to-face training. All right, I have one more point I just want to make really quickly about what neuroplasticity, I think, says about disability in this society. What I take from the theory of neuroplasticity is that it acknowledges essentially that we're all clearly neurodiverse, not just people with autism or schizophrenia or cerebral palsy. Each person's brain is different in that our chemical, genetic, metabolic, and hormonal makeup interacts with the environment and experiences in individual ways. What neuroplasticity offers as well is that we can change for better or worse based on our environment, training, and experience. Some neuroscientists and psychologists take neuroplasticity to mean that we can change those who are just a little bit more diverse by using a variety of biological and behavioral treatments. And I think there's much to be learned from research into the minds of any particular population, whether it's deaf ASL users, people with autism, bilingual speakers, musicians, visual artists, as well as doing studies on the general population, those who are just typical, of course, with informed consent. But I also think scientists, educators, medical staff, and politicians can use those results not to normalize those really neurodiverse people, but to consult with people with different brains and provide the public with information about neurodiversity and expand the tools to understand it, respect it, and change environmental factors that that allow our brains to adapt to a wide variety of brains. And that's more in line with the social theory of disability, that the social contracts of society disable people who are neurodiverse or physically, sensorily, or mentally diverse from participating to the fullest in the world of capitalism. So I will end here. I want to stress we're not destined to be these stark individuals because our brains are all unique. We have commonalities and experience, thought, and memories. But I do think that individuality of experience also explains our need to discuss our thoughts and our ideas with other people to figure out where the similarities and differences are. And that doesn't exclude the possibility of us living in a world in which we have shared knowledge and shared communities in common. Clearly, humans seek out social bonding. We want to participate in groups and communicate and understand what we can and often must work together. So ultimately, I think that their theory of neuroplasticity is based on a dialectical approach to how we as humans, as animals, relate to the world, make sense of it, change it as we are changed by it. And understanding neuroplasticity really indicates to me that a socialist society is possible, but it's not guaranteed. From capitalism, in which the vast majority of people are oppressed in this capitalist society, as we work to create wealth but not enjoy it fully, the idea that our brains are inherently adaptable and ready to create change convinces me that humans are neurologically capable of creating a much better world.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.